funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. When does travel writing cease to be tourist advice, and when does it become an art? Paul Theroux is the dean of American travel writers, literate, wide-ranging, observant, and a touch acerbic. His most recent travel book, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, finds him retracing the trip across Europe and Asia he took 35 years ago for the Great Railway Bazaar, the book that launched his career. Ghost Train to the Eastern Star will be released in paperback in 2 weeks. In addition to his travel writings, Theroux is a prolific novelist. Several of his books have been adapted into films, including The Mosquito Coast and St. Jack. He's also written criticism, children's books, and short story collections. Paul, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks very much, Jerome. It's delightful. I'm delighted to be with you.
You must have a cast iron stomach. Quite a few years ago, actually, when airline food was disappointing but not disappeared, Calvin Trillin wrote about how he would just bring his own hamper on board and people would look longingly at his wheels of brie and his smoked salmon. And of course, that's the way all of us travel these days, it seems. But in Ghost Train, I read, once again, you were just hopping onto trains, trusting whatever was on board over and over again. It was pretty much, does this have a dining car and what can I finagle?
Food is the least of my worries in travel. It's funny that people do mention, they say, what was the food like? Did you eat the food? Was everything all right? But I seldom think about it. I remember I wrote a book about Africa. I traveled from Cairo to Cape Town. The book is called Dark Star mm-hmm. Safari. And I remember days when all I ate was peanuts or fried, they fried dough by the side of the road. And if you're on a bus or on a train, you buy these just fried cakes. I was pretty glad to get something to eat. A lot of people have nothing to eat. My problem is not food. It's never food. But maybe I have a good cast iron stomach, as you say. But it's usually getting from place to place. How do I get from here to there? My policy in 40 years of traveling has been more than 40, actually. I started traveling in 1963 when I was in the Peace Corps. So that's 46 years. My policy is always to travel overland. Airplane food always seems delicious to me when I get it, compared to what I've been eating. Seriously, it's wonderful stuff. But the problem is really in locomotion. It's how I get from one place to another, and without getting hassled by local people or questioned or I don't know, seriously delayed. If I get a handful of peanuts one day and a boiled egg or something like that, I'm glad.
Yet in Ghost Train, you mention in passing that you were suffering from gout. And
oh, yeah.
One of the treatments for that has to do with diet.
Yes, that's true. My gout, though, came from my Africa trip, the trip through Africa and Dark Star Safari, where I was on a tributary of the Zambezi River, and I was seriously dehydrated. We had run out of water, so we were drinking the river. And when you drink a river and you see hippos in a river on one side of the river and you're drinking the other, you think, I wonder what I'm drinking here. But anyway, so that put a damper on my drinking, and probably I didn't drink enough. But to make a long story short, I became seriously dehydrated, something that you shouldn't let happen to you. Although in Texas, I'm sure that it happens more often than here in Massachusetts. And I had some kind of kidney thing. I mean, I'm sure it traumatized my kidneys. And about really 2 months later, I got my first attack of gout from this dehydration. And I've had it. It's not something I recommend to anyone, but there's treatment for it. I take a daily pill, but sometimes it works, sometimes not. And that and cataract surgery arose from traveling. Those are the two things. Having to have cataract surgery from just being out in the sun for 40 years and the gout. But I take pills with me for gout. So if I get an attack, and sometimes I get an acute attack, and it's not much fun. But that's just, it's the breaks. People have it worse than me.
you mentioned about your major concern about getting to someplace overland. You don't like luxury travel, and you often endure a fair degree of hardship. Yet the way you travel is actually something of a luxury, it seems to me. The only time I've ever done something remotely like it was when I spent the summer at Oxford, Trinity College, Oxford, and I came to England a month early and just spent the month wandering wherever I wanted to.
Yeah.
And that's the luxury, is all the time in the world and no particular place you have to be.
Who was paying for it? Your folks, maybe.
Partly. I had saved up some money.
Okay. No, the thing is, yes, it's a luxury. I haven't had a job since 1971. So I was teaching at the University of Singapore, and if you can scrape the money together and go travel, yeah, it's the ideal thing. Just to be a happy wanderer. But I sing for my supper. You know, it's true that I have the luxury of open-ended travel. I go away, my wife says, when are you coming back? I say, I'll give you a call. A month goes by, another 2 weeks go by, 2 months go by, and she says, when are you coming home? And I say, you know, any day now. Not many people have that luxury. First, my wife is very understanding. But secondly, I very rarely traveled and not written about it. So that virtually every bit of travel that I've done, for example, I drove cross-country last May, drove through Texas, I drove through Amarillo, among other places, from Santa Fe, and then just kept going sort of east. But even at my late age, and I have a reasonably good income, but I felt I want to write about it to pay for the trip, but also write about it to concentrate my mind on the travel. So and as far as luxury travel, if you're talking about really luxury travel, that kind of, you know, five-star, great food, wonderful service, persons, you know, people rushing around, getting you things and, you know, fanning you, there's nothing to write about there. I mean, I've been on luxury cruises and I've been in luxury hotels, but apart from, you know, having a very nice time, wish you were here, there's nothing to say about it.
In a number of your travel books, but particularly in Ghost Train, you write about your predecessors, the great travel writers you've tried to emulate, Joseph Conrad, Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh. Other than literary style, a talent with observation and language, what sets them apart? What makes their writing great?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention Conrad is a hero of mine, but you say, what makes their writing great? Is it both a very simple and a very difficult question. How they came to be great writers, Hemingway, Conrad, Greene, and all these other people, is really to do with the origin of their early life and their apprenticeship and just learning how to write. But Conrad said, above all, I want to make you see. He said, my mission as a writer is to make you see. And I've always taken that to be the motto for my traveling is to, and if you're saying what sets these people apart, it's their ability to show the reader how people look, how the landscape looks, what it smells like, what it looks like, the sounds that it, and to recreate this landscape. A great writer is someone who admits you to his or her world, and a great travel writer is someone who is taking the trip for you so that you see where it is, you see how people talk, if there's menace or terror or fear or suspense or pleasure or, you know, sensuousness, then that's all in the book. And I hope, you know, my mission is that. It's for the reader to see it, see what's happening and to see a landscape. In Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, I was in the country of Turkmenistan, a place I had never been before. I haven't spent much of my life thinking about Turkmenistan, and I'm a traveler. I've even been to, it borders Iran and Azerbaijan and Uzbekistan and Afghanistan. But what is it? Where is it? What is it? So there's some chapter of the book, I don't know which number it is, but it's about the dictator of Turkmenistan, the people of Turkmenistan, the landscape, a desert landscape, and my taking the train through it, and then being there. And Turkmenistan sounds like, you know, people say the stands, it's a stan. So they seem indistinguishable from each other. But I felt in that book, my wish was to make it live as a place so that people, when the name came up, people would say, I can see the market, I can see the people, I can see the gold statues and all the rest of the experience that I had there. So it's, you know, it's to make the reader see. That's what sets this writing apart.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, and our guest today is novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux. If you wish to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. I forgive a writer an awful lot for just the right line, the few observations that I keep. One I've kept for 35 years now is when you traveled into Venice, because you did it overland, and you came in through that awful industrial flat plain to get to Venice, and when you finally came to the city, you described it as a drawing room in a gas station.
Yeah.
And I was a few lines like that in a book are all that I need to keep reading.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. To remember something that I wrote those lines many years ago, and I was there last year, as a matter of fact, back in Venice, and I was struck anew by what a graceful, wonderful, almost like a Capriccio, you know, Venice with the lagoons and the beautiful churches and houses and villas and whatnot, and the fact that it's surrounded by oil refineries and quite a polluted area of Italy, and actually the most traffic-ridden part of Italy, although there's no motor traffic on the Venetian canals. It's just a very strange thing, enclosed by this beautiful city, enclosed by an industrial landscape. Very, very odd. The selectivity of photographs just show, when you see pictures of Venice, you never see the other part. What the travel writer can do is show you that Venice is not just the pearl of the Adriatic, but it's also an appendage to a very polluted landscape.
That's the way that the movies always show it. You come in from the water side. You never sort of see the back side of the city.
Yeah. It's the other side of it. But, I mean, many cities are like that. Manhattan, New York City is like that. Manhattan looks like a wonderful place. Looks very stately with skyscrapers, but anyone driving from Kennedy Airport or LaGuardia Airport, and the city goes through, you know, graveyards, slums, ghettos, ruins, and you know, and pretty awful looking place, and, you know, overdeveloped landscape, to get to the Emerald City. Of course, it's, you know, it's very nice, but I think that the reality of travel is that it's not this only sightseeing, but it's connecting places, and I think the important aspect of travel is, if you're traveling overland, is that you're able to connect the shifting sands, the kaleidoscope too of a landscape, so that it's not all either awful or all beautiful, but you see how one is connected to the other. New York couldn't run as a city without being without having a workforce, and New York's workforce is, of course, in the suburbs. So so you see how the city runs by lots of people who don't live in the city.
This is Think on KERA 90.1, and I'm Jerome Weeks. Filling in for Chris Boyd, we're talking to Paul Theroux, novelist and travel writer, and we'll be back right after this break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Welcome to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, and my guest today is travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux. Of course, you've been to many places that have been that are pretty far off the beaten path. I recall a leper colony in Malawi, for instance. But you're not parachuting off cliffs or scaling K2 with your bare hands. Sizable parts of your books are spent in places like New Delhi or Venice or Texas, places that anyone can really get to. But what's different is that you get there by train, sometimes in the off season. What's so remarkable about that? Why does that reveal so much about these places?
There's two points that you raise. One is the off season. The other is the train. I felt in the 19 when I started, I was taking trains in the 1960s. I thought, there's going to be a time when we will have no trains. And I always found them a very pleasant way to travel. You could go anywhere on them virtually. And it's very unstressful. So you can sit down, you can walk around, you can write, you can read, look out the window, and talk to people. You can also sleep on a train, eat on a train. You can live on a train in a way that you can't on a bus or a car or a plane. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to go, say, from London to Paris to Turkey to Afghanistan on the train? All I do is get on the train in Victoria Station in London, and then I end up in Afghanistan. That's what happened. I mean, there's no train in Afghanistan, but the town of Herat, which you read about now because of the war in Afghanistan, is right next to the town of Meshed in Iran. So you can go from London to Meshed on the train. Anyone can. You still can, as a matter of fact. And then after Afghanistan, you pick up and you go through Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and so forth. I thought it was just a very easy way of doing it. Just get on, and you can get off the train and whenever you like. And there's in most places a train every day, so you don't get stuck. It's not the case in Africa. The trains are rough and ready. But in the 1960s, you mentioned the leper colony. That leper colony was on a railway line in the Central African country of Nyasaland, which later became Malawi. And I remember getting on the train, and it was a wood-burning steam locomotive, and off we went. And then it dropped us, and it went away, and then, darkness fell, and you think, I got him in the middle of nowhere. But there was only a train, I think there was one a week there, so you get stuck otherwise. But there are a lot of trains running where there are no roads. I mean, this is true in China. It's true in India. It's true in parts of South America, too. And that's an advantage that there's no other way. You could fly, I suppose, but taking the train, you see this long panning shot of the landscape. Now, I haven't done all my books on trains, but whenever there was a train, I've wanted to take it, just for the experience of it, and the sense that it might be a vanishing way of traveling, and that I want to do it, before it passes away. In the same spirit, though, when Concorde, the supersonic jet, was scheduled to be put in mothballs, and I took it. I had never taken it. I thought, if I don't take this supersonic jet, I'm never going to get a chance. So I went on Concorde in the same spirit that I've gone on trains. And, Concorde is gone. I don't even know when there'll be another one back, but that was a way of crossing the Atlantic, and I think it was 3.5 hours. That's pretty good. It might have even been less than that. Maybe it was three. But all I know is I got on the plane, and literally in the blink of an eye, before I could take the whole experience in, I had arrived in London. So it's trying all sorts of travel, but there's ways of traveling that are more conducive to the writing experience.
In Ghost Train, when you retrace some of the trip in Railway Bazaar, for at least in the first half of the book, until you get to India, we discover that for most of the people, you're headed the wrong way. That you're headed east, and almost everyone else is headed west.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Why was that?
I think just because because Western Europe represents work and life to people, to most of Asia, to a lot of Eastern Europe, to a lot of people in Africa. I mean, one of the features of Venice, which we mentioned earlier as a lovely place, is that there are plenty of Africans there selling artifacts. Where do they come from? Where do they live? No one seems to know where they live. But, I mean, there's a book to be written, I think, about the Africans in Europe who just turn up on the, you see them at, on the side, they're in Venice, they're in Rome, they're in London, they're in Paris, and they're selling artifacts. They come from Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, Senegal, West Africa mainly. They make their way up through North Africa. And, you know, North Africa and Italy, you could practically swim from Tunisia to Sicily. But they go in boats. Anyway, end up there. So this migration route from people going west to Western Europe or in, and hoping to get to the States, too, I suppose. There's a whole movement afoot in the world of people moving, looking for work, looking for a life. You have it in Texas. People, I met a guy in the Sudan who told me that he said he lived in New York. He was Sudanese. And he said, I said, how did you get to New York? And he said, I went to Mexico. This is from the Sudan to Mexico with a group of other Sudanese. We were smuggled across the border in a fish truck. We then made our way to, we worked in fields, as agricultural workers, picked peaches in Georgia, eventually got to New York City. And what's he doing? I think he said he was doing some sort of manual labor in New York City. But this is, it's not just Mexicans who come to Texas and Arizona and New Mexico. It's Pakistanis, Chinese, and Africans. So it's, you ask about the people I met when I was traveling east, I saw people going west. But I mean, the whole world is focused on finding work in the States or in Western Europe. So you're likely to find that, you know, in a lot of places, people saying, I mean, they might say, Yankee, go home, but they'll say, take me with you.
Right. You they keep telling you, and take me to America, after they've said that they hated the war in Iraq and hated President
George
Bush.
We hate George Bush. America's doing the wrong thing. Please, how can I get there? Help me get a visa. Well, I mean, that's the contradiction. They're economic migrants. They don't know who George Washington is or, you know, or anything. But yes, they would like to work there. And please, you know, could they have a Big Mac and a new car?
Speaking of travel in Texas, what do you think of the idea that's continually proposed and continually shot down of high-speed trains across Texas? It seems to be an ideal location for them in America because we have a number of large cities, but 4 or 5 hours apart by car, and it's flat plains. But what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I mean, that if you go to Japan, for example, the Japanese export cars to the States and to everywhere else, but the Japanese are not great big car drivers. They are mainly riders of railways. And you could go. They built a tunnel that connects Honshu to Hokkaido. It's really one of the world's longest undersea tunnels. So, if you go there, you'll see how high speed trains can transform a landscape and actually, you know, solve your energy crisis. Texas lends itself to high speed trains between cities, and would probably be a great thing. It's expensive to put in. To install it, but the technology exists. I think the difficulty is that the high-speed train really can't connect the big cities of the United States. They have to connect, say, the Northeast corridor of the States between Boston, New York, and Washington, for example. A high-speed train is the best option. If I were going to Washington, D.C., or New York from where I am now, near Boston, I would take the train. I wouldn't drive, and I wouldn't fly. I mean, the train is not only cheaper, it's faster, it's less hassle, and you end up in the middle of the city. That could be the case for Texas. And the countries that have trains have kind of solved that problem. Germany's one, Holland is another. Europe is connected with a number of high-speed trains. Britain, to a certain extent, but Japan is that's the gold standard of high-speed rail travel. So you can get on the train at the top of Japan, the very north, and end up, you know, in the south, in a matter of about might take 12 hours, but it's an overnighter, and I don't know. I think it's a great way of traveling. It's also I don't know how long we could go on building roads and having cars. Obviously, they have some use, but once a train, if someone actually put a high-speed rail link in Texas, they'd see that it would pay for itself and would be a great option.
Let's go to a caller. Terrence in Duncanville, you have a question for Paul Theroux?
Yes. My question was on the difference between travel writing and fiction. After listening to you for the length of the show, my question largely has been answered. But I think it's brilliant the way you describe the difference between travel writing and fiction because of the necessity to actually want to visit and to create the option for people to visit places that they might not have ever thought that they would have been able to visit. When you were talking about the way that you try to describe the market and the actually being in a market and talking with the vendors and things like that, I thought that that was pretty good because I never thought about reading travel writing, but I love to travel. And so I was interested in maybe how you approach travel writing different from just regular fiction.
Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting perspective. It's the approach is that travel writing is based on an actual physical visit to a place, whereas you can stay home and you know in your room upstairs and write about a place without ever having gone there. Many people do. I remember I wrote The Mosquito Coast. You mentioned it in your introduction. It was made into a movie with Harrison Ford. The Mosquito Coast, which is one of my favorite books, I wrote out of a kind of yearning. I wrote it I was living in London for about 15 years. And I really hated it. It was rainy. It was cold. I found it unfriendly. But my kids were in school there, and they didn't want to leave. So I had this yearning to just be in a hot country. And I fantasized about just taking my family to Honduras, and just seeing what life would be like. But I remember I wrote this book, which is a novel, about Honduras, and I recreated the jungle and the experience and the family and everything just by sitting in this cold, rainy city. And it had nothing to do with travel. It had everything to do with the power of the imagination to evoke a place. So a travel book is the reverse of that. You go to a place, you take a long trip, you have the experience, you talk to people, and you come back and write about it. That's pretty straightforward, except that a trip can be a difficult thing. And if you have a life at home and a family and so forth, you get homesick, it's difficult, it's expensive, and it's a lot of trouble, because it's not much trouble to stay home. But fiction recreates or the imagination creates the travel experience, whereas the travel book is an account, a truthful account of what happened on a particular trip.
But as a form of nonfiction, the travel log would seem to provide a natural narrative. You have beginning, middle, and end. But in my experience, a lot of travel writing just becomes sort of one damned thing after another. So how do you shape events and characters that you really don't have any control over into a pleasing narrative if your return is pretty anticlimactic?
That's true, and that's an interesting question because you take the trip and you say, I'm going to take this trip, and you hope that something will happen to you, and you hope that it will be revealing. How you shape it is that's the rub. I mean, that's the whole task of a travel book is giving it a kind of narrative shape, and so that the reader will stay interested. It means that you leave out things, and the things that you leave out are, what are the aspects of travel that everybody hates? Nuisance and delay, and most of travel is nuisance and delay. If anyone takes a trip, You know, people tell you, oh, they just went to wherever, you know. In Texas, it might be, I just went to Mexico. Or here, it might be, I don't know, just went to Canada. But whatever it is, they'll talk about the delay at the border, an idiot that, that shortchanged them, you know, something. But there'll be something, and you think, you start yawning, you think, I heard this before. No one wants to read about delays, the difficulty of getting a visa, or waiting in line, or a plane canceled. All of those things are common experiences that I never write about. I've never written about.
Well, you do get back at some nuisances that come in along the way. I mean, there's some acid portraits in your work.
Yes, that's true. They're not nuisances, though. I tend to write more about hardships. I'm not interested in nuisances so much as I am about hardships. So I try to write about hardship. If I might, there might be an aside about something going wrong or an idiot, but that's part of life's rich tapestry. But you can't make a meal of that. You can't really go on and on about a delay, a missed plane, or a missed opportunity, or waiting in line for a long period of time. I think that even now, I don't write about illness either. I mean, I got sick a lot in the trip, but I wrote about one time getting ill, not feeling too hot. It was in Malaysia, actually. But I think that the shape of the narrative is the art of the travel book. But also, a traveler has to be very lucky. I consider myself a very lucky traveler, and that I try to make things happen. I try to look people up, and you know, talk to people. But I've been very fortunate as a traveler. I'm the fortunate traveler, and so that my books are about things that actually happened, and some of them are amazing.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks. Our guest is Paul Theroux, novelist and travel writer, and we will be back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. And my guest today is novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372, and our email is think@kera.org. As we mentioned earlier, you're going to be giving the keynote address at the Mayborne Literary Nonfiction Conference, and the title is The World is Elsewhere, A Life in Search of Stories. The line is from Coriolanus, There is a World Elsewhere. What does it mean to you?
I felt when I was growing up that the world that I was living in was not the real world. It was the bosom of my family, and that real life, the real happenings, the adventures, the world as it really existed was somewhere else, far away. And I thought, I really can't be a writer. I can't see the world. Nothing will happen to me unless I leave home. And I had this very strong suspicion that I had to get away, and that the world was elsewhere. So the contradiction to that was that when I was in my earlier life, I thought, well, my family's normal and no one else is, but we're normal. And I realized that when I went away, not only that the world is elsewhere, it is somewhere else, but also my family wasn't that normal. And I thought I had a perspective on my family, and also a perspective on my country. And having this vantage point by going away, you learn a lot about yourself and about about where you came from. So it's a simple truth. But when people say, "I'd like to be a writer. What shall I do? What should I read?" I say, "Well, of course you've got to read. You have to love books and love reading, love the word. But also you need to leave home. You can't stay home and write. You really have to go away. Even if you're just going to a nearby town, you've got to leave. You can't be a writer and live under your family's roof." So, that's why they say college students get a lot of criticism. But one of the great things about going to college is that you are leaving the house. You're going away. You know, ideally, you're going and living with other students, and you're going to a different city or a different state. And that's a very, very helpful thing. It shakes up the mind and helps you see.
Speaking of your family, let's go to Tim, the very patient Tim in Dallas.
Well, thank you, actually. I loved St. Jack and the Mosquito Coast. I read them 20 years ago and noticed the name. And then as the years went on, speaking of your family, I started to run into the Theroux name. I read a great novel by a guy, Alexander Theroux, and figured,
my brother. Oh. Yeah.
And then read this series of novels that were translated from Arabic to English by Peter Theroux. And I'm going,
that's right. That's also another brother. My
brother. And then another book by Marcel Theroux I read a couple years ago. It was fantastic.
That's my son. He's got a new book called Far North.
Turn on
Marcel
the TV, and
son.
There's a Louis Theroux, this really funny English kid doing great stuff. And there's
other son. That's
Get
Marcel's
on Six
brother.
Feet Under, and there's an actor. So these are all related, right?
Justin Theroux is my nephew. And
wow.
So yeah,
what's up with that?
I take my hat off to you. I mean, so you got them all. You got them
all. What do you all eat, and how can I get some to feed my children?
You know, I don't know how to answer that question, but except that
thanks very
my
much,
father
Tim.
Was my father was a reader, but he was also great in taking us out and showing us around. My family was fairly dysfunctional. I mean, it's not one big happy family, but we all loved reading, and we all loved getting out. I think my father was a big inspiration of just showing us the world, and not the wider world, but just outside the house. There's also, I come from a big family, and big families tend to produce solitude or the wish for solitude. So you want to, I mean, there's a lot of you, so you're trying to make your mark. If there's one person, you can be. If you're an only child, I think it's difficult because you have really so much pressure on you to succeed. When in a big family, you have no pressure except the inner spark. But I mean, Marcel's my son, Alexander is my brother, Justin, who's the actor, is my nephew, but very close to my kids, the same age as my kids, and Peter is an Arabic scholar, and so I translated all these books from Arabic. And we all went our separate ways. Some of us, Peter went to Harvard. He's very well educated. I'm not particularly well educated, though I'm probably more widely traveled than he is. But I think that family life can produce it, not only by positive, but by negative effects, that you're in a big family and you want to get out. So you spend a lot of time in the library just to have solitude. It may have worked that way with me.
One of the things that has impressed me about you as a travel writer is when you go to many of these places, you as a local authority, as a local insight, you look up the writers, Borges in Argentina, for instance.
Yes.
And I've always thought that adds a certain richness or depth to your writing. Is it just a personal inclination on your part? You were interested in the writers, or is it a way of getting into a country?
I think it's both. I think it's a way of getting into a country, but I think that, say in the case of Borges or Murakami in Japan or Nadine Gordimer in South Africa, these are national writers. They're writers who are loved by their readers in those countries and who love their country. They love Borges loved Buenos Aires. Nadine Gordimer is the writer of Johannesburg and of South Africa, and Murakami of Tokyo. And there are lots of other writers that I've looked up. I also think, I admire writers. I know how much work it is to write a book, and the idea of a writer in a place, giving, evoking this sense of place. That's the mission of the writer, and writing about the people in a place. So if you go to the writer, you find out so much. And in most cases, they're people I admire, just personally admire. I admired Borges. I was thrilled to meet him, and then I read stories to him. He's blind, as you know, was blind. And Gordimer, when I was in the Peace Corps in Africa in the 60s, and I used to read Nadine Gordimer's novels, and it helped me understand that part of Africa. I mean, she was writing in South Africa. I was in Central Africa, in Malawi, and it helped a lot. It helped me to understand them. So, it's all those things, and it's a very helpful thing. Writers tend to be somewhat unbalanced, dysfunctional people. The second time I use that word in this conversation. So it's not that you're looking for a meal or, you know, hospitality, but just to meet them and see their country through their eyes is very helpful.
It's interesting. It's about Borges that he is such a writer of that city, given the fact that he was blind.
Yep. I must say that one of the high points of his life, he told me, was seeing the Alamo, going to the Alamo.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, going to Texas.
I met him when he came to UT Austin to give a talk. And I
oh, really? So lucky you.
Yes. Yeah. He was a very sweet, very gentle man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also funny.
Yes.
I think he was he with his mother on that trip?
No. He was with his last wife or girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. So, but he went with his mother. There was certainly a trip to Texas where he went with his mother. Mm-hmm. And then the woman is called Maria Kodama.
That's right.
Whom he ultimately married, mm-hmm. a Japanese-Argentine woman. So you would have perhaps met her.
Nothing I had read about him led me to realize that he had a horrible stutter.
Yeah. Yeah, he has. I don't know how horrible, but it was a stammer.
Well, it was, I guess, in public when he was giving a public address.
Yes, yes, yes. Privately, it wasn't very marked. But his blindness was. He said it was a gift. It's a dubious gift, but it helped him concentrate. He said in this darkness. But for a reader, very, very difficult. But he had people reading to him.
Speaking of all these memories and things, this is the week that everyone's been celebrating and commemorating the 40th anniversary of the moon landing.
Yes.
And I'm not going to talk about space travel with you, but rather it reminded me of the scene on the train in Turkmenistan.
Yep.
When an elderly gentleman asks you about the moon landing. I was wondering if you could recount that anecdote.
Yeah, he said, there's a story in the Islamic world that Neil Armstrong, sometimes confused with Louis Armstrong, in the Islamic world, when he got to the moon, he heard chanting, and it was someone reciting verses from the Quran. And the urban myth is that Neil Armstrong heard this, I think chanting hadiths or verses from the Quran, and that he, after coming back from the moon, he converted to Islam. He's the astronaut who became a Muslim. Mm-hmm. So a man said I was on the train in Turkmenistan, and a man who was a cotton picker, an older man, just a peasant from the fields, asked me whether it was true. He said, "You're American, and is it true that an astronaut or a man who went to the moon heard this?" And he said he'd heard this, and he said he felt it was true. I said I wasn't too sure. Actually, it was the first time I'd heard it. But then I looked a little deeper into it, and it turned out that Neil Armstrong is the man who was reputedly heard this, the mystical verses being recited on the moon.
So you're saying there was some truth behind this? Or
did I say, well, no. No, I'm saying that's the urban myth.
And so,
well, that's the belief.
You encountered it on this train, but you said that it was an urban legend. You encountered it elsewhere?
When I asked someone, I actually asked my brother Peter, who's an Arabic scholar, and he said that that he had heard that story.
Huh.
And he had spent some time in he's translated books from Arabic. He'd spent time in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. And he said he had heard that. So it's a story that's circulating. It's a bit like, you know, maybe it's Quranic apocrypha, like, you know, it's the apocrypha relating to the Bible is that Jesus went to Cornwall, Jesus went to England, that Judas had red hair, that Judas didn't hang himself, that he exploded, his guts blew up. So there's all, you know, it's biblical apocrypha, which some people collect, and it's sometimes mixed up with the reality of the Bible, or you know, the text of the Bible, and the same is true, I suppose, of the Quran.
Let's go to the very patient Christy in Athens. Christy, are you there?
Oh yes, I am here, Mr. Thoreau. In 1981, my friend, I was living in Holland, in the Netherlands, and my friend Nick Pakfasa introduced me to your writing, which was a revelation, and you in turn introduced me to V.S. Naipaul, which is yet another. This summer, I'm reading alternately you and Jose Saramago, and I consider you gentlemen to be peers.
Well, that's really nice of you.
You have enriched my life for almost 30 years, and a huge Texas thank you for that. I've lived a lot of places, and I'm now in Texas, and I'm looking forward to, it appears you have written about Texas.
Not deeply, but I have been there and I've written a little bit about it in a travel book. But I was going to say, have you read my book about Naipaul called Servidia's Shadow, about my friendship with Naipaul that ended?
Which book?
It's about the beginning, middle, and end of a friendship.
It's called Servidia's Shadow.
No.
Yeah, there's a biography of Naipaul appeared last year saying what a monster he is, actually. But in my book, he's not a monster. He's just a difficult friend. But it's a memoir of Naipaul. Servidia's Shadow, I recommend it to you.
I found it ironic in reading that you have occasionally get have the reputation of being crusty or grumpy or judgmental, and here you are with Naipaul, who comes across much more cantankerous than
you've ever appeared. Yeah, I don't know where it comes that I'm crusty and cantankerous. I you can see that I'm a jolly little hobbit with furry feet. If you're a traveler, you have to be pretty good-natured and pretty patient. So I don't know where that comes from. Maybe from acerbic comments in my books, but you know, personally, you'll find me a delightful person.
I have so far.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
May I say one thing about NPR?
Very
when I was
quickly.
Driving through Texas and driving through the states, NPR was the sustaining voice.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
This is Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks. Have a good day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.